Okay, we continue with the fasting.
Yes, thank you, Hans. Good morning, everybody. So this month, we only have one paper to discuss with the board. Agenda paper 5A has had some minor changes and just reflecting the board's decisions to date. So I don't intend to discuss that. I intend to go straight to agenda paper 5B, if that's okay. So this paper considers whether when classifying claims that grant not the holder of the claim, but the issuer, the right to settle the claim in a way that would meet the definition of equity or in a way that would meet the definition of a liability. And the paper considers whether economic incentives should be considered when classifying such claims. So when looking at those two outcomes, whether the probability or the likelihood that the entity might exercise one outcome or the other should be considered. Now, why is this a question? This question has, under IS 32, historically come up with respect to preference shares with dividends that reset if the preference share is not redeemed. Many commentators have supported the liability classification of such claims. However, they were using the idea that the entity is economically compelled to transfer resources to support that desired classification outcome. The board has in the past said that while IS 32 does have this notion of indirect obligations, that economic compulsion itself it does not come into the classification decision. Now, first of all, in the staff analysis in paragraphs 29-33, what we set out is that under the gamma approach that the board is focusing on as part of this project, that approach would classify those problematic instruments as liabilities without the need to consider whether the entity is economically compelled to transfer resources. It would be classified as a liability under the gamma approach because such instruments would be for an obligation for an amount that is independent of the entity. So it's not a residual amount. Having said that, the question might still arise for some other types of claims that not so aware of any problems with classification at the moment. However, people would still might find the fact that the entity might transfer resources or exercise that right that would result in a liability kind of outflow of cash as equity. They might just find that counterintuitive. Some people find that counterintuitive, others don't. In the staff analysis, we just look at whether economic incentives should be considered, and if so, how. In paragraphs 35-46, what we set out is that under IS 32, that the requirements include this notion of indirect obligations. An indirect obligation would meet the definition of a financial liability under IS 32 on initial recognition and thereafter. It's a representation of the rights and obligations of the contract. Under the gamma approach, we think that notion should be carried forward, and so the indirect obligation notion would be carried forward under gamma to reflect the features that we're looking at under that approach. However, importantly, this is different to some of the notions that of economic compulsion that have come up in the past, and which is why the board said while there's indirect obligations under 32, economic compulsion doesn't come into it. And this is because the extent to which an entity might be economically compelled to exercise its rights or not will vary from time to time. So this is evident for the preference shares with resets, because even if they're set up in such a way, ignoring gamma approach for the time being, even if they're set up in such a way that the equity settlement outcome might be unfavorable, so deferring it might be unfavorable, a change in interest rates may make that option favorable. And so there's going to be a change in that, in the extent of that incentive. In paragraphs 47 to 55, we just set out if we are going to consider economic incentives in the classification of liabilities and equity, there are a number of follow-on questions and challenges that we would have to address, not least of which would be how strong those incentives need to be to amount to economic compulsion, but also how to account for subsequent changes in the extent of that economic incentive, in terms of how to do reclassifications, how to account for income and expense. In our view, this would raise more questions that we'll answer. In particular, if we're pursuing under the gamma approach, an approach that will deal with the preference shares with resets as a liability without getting into some of these issues. And that would, of course, include this notion of indirect obligation. So in our view, what we conclude in the paper is that we do not think that the likelihood of the entity exercising one option or the other should be considered in classifying liabilities and equity. With that, I'll just turn it over to the board for any comments or questions.
Changwu?
Thank you very much. This is another very interesting paper to read. So thank you for your good analysis. Clarification. So if we adopt view A, then we just apply gamma approach. Any interesting instruments here, right?
Yes.
So view A with the gamma approach with view A, that solve that counterintuitive thing in your paragraph 19, right? Yeah, 19.
If the counterintuitive thing is that instruments that are equity classified are still going to result in
right.
resource transfers,
yes.
then it's not going to solve that. In our view, equity classification should not preclude the entity from transferring resources. The entity is always going to transfer resources to equity holders. The question is whether there's an obligation to do so. That's the question. So some people might see some instruments as counterintuitive. I think for the dividend with resets, that might be more because of they're more like fixed interest kind of instruments. However, it's not going to address the concerns that there is going to be an outflow of resources for equity claims, but that's always going to be the case.
So if we still some counterintuitive result on this classification.
Well, some people might think it's counterintuitive.
Right.
The application.
Most other people, I guess. Except that, yeah, reflecting the rights and obligations, you know, if the entity does have the rights under an equity instrument to, you know, repurchase it or on the market or to pay distributions, that's fine. Even if it's favorable to do so, I think some people accept that and don't find that counterintuitive.
Yes, but let's see, even there. Some most ASAP members prefer kind of a view A, right? So they don't have any the subjective judgment on the what economic incentive, what economic convergence, everything. However, what you just described is some have different ideas on this kind of classification. But it seems to me many investors, especially investors, are very important in when you decide which approach you will take. So it seems to me many investors, they are basically not accountants, they are just maybe economists or something, you know, they are interested in the price and valuation.
Yes. Yeah.
And also the classification. So professional accountants might prefer the Bayview A because it's simple. We don't exercise any subjective judgment. However, the valuable information on classifying these financial instruments might not be good for those you know, investors. So what I'm saying is, even though there are many subjective things in this exercising economic incentive thing option, we still need to think more carefully on this kind of a complex things to be included in our standard.
But I think, Chung-Wu, especially when we look at the gamma approach, which is also going to provide additional information about equity instruments.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So there is a portion of investors out there, for instance, the equity investors, the ordinary shareholders, who would want, you know, everything other than ordinary shares to be liabilities. However, by providing more information about equity instruments, by giving them some clear signals from the classification as liabilities and equity in terms of the balance sheet aggregates and what's included and excluded from the perform in terms of P&L and the separate presentation requirements, I think we would be able to give them better information about those different economic phenomena. So I think from an investor's perspective, what the way we're approaching is probably better than simply just classifying everything. Because even the ordinary shares, if you go down the route where, you know, any sort of, even if you take a very extreme view about how strong the economic incentive is, there might be a very strong economic incentive to pay dividends or to repurchase shares. And so the question, it becomes a very slippery slope to classifying even, you know, ordinary shares as liabilities. So I think we need to come up with some classifications that work and distinguish between the rights and obligations of these different instruments to provide that information to users. One way or another, we have to do that.
I agree with where the staff have landed for a few reasons. And one of the reasons I was is the example that you just used. I think that if we go down this no practical ability to avoid type of route with financial instruments, it's going to be really complex and judgmental for people to apply. And I think there will be cases where the consequences for some companies of stopping paying their ordinary dividends, and they've always paid ordinary dividends and people hold their shares because they pay ordinary dividends, could be extreme. And I think we would get quickly into a situation where you have no equity in some companies if we're not careful. And knowing where to draw the line is going to be very difficult. So I think it's too complex. Also, I think even people who think that, at least in some cases, the outcomes can be counterintuitive would probably still think there's circumstances where, for example, if the options are very out of the money, that they wouldn't want to have a debt classification. So I think that if we go down an economic compulsion type of route or no practical to avoid route, we necessarily are going to have reassessment. And if we have to have reassessment, I think we're going to have then huge complexity because we're going to be flip-flopping potentially out of liability to equity classification, which has got remeasurement implications which are complicated. And I thought it was interesting in the ASAF meeting actually that the FASB raised that point because it was something that they've looked at before, that complexity that comes with that. So given all of that, I understand that people think that sometimes the information provided by the sort of blunt equity classification doesn't tell you the whole story for these types of instruments. But I think looking at the disclosure and presentation that's coming along with this is the way to address that, rather than adding this in as the solution to address those problems. So I agree with where you've landed.
Just a comment on sort of the... I don't want to completely equate practical ability to avoid with economic compulsion. I think we're still going to... The board's still going to discuss, you know, the notion of practical ability to avoid as part of the conceptual framework project. But I think... Definitely, one of the interpretations of that was this point about economic compulsion. However, regardless of where the board kind of ends up landing in terms of practical ability to avoid in the framework, I think it's good to address this specific point as part of the FIES project, because it's going to invariably come up.
Well, I think just on that. Sorry, not to add confusion, but I think some of the feedback we got on the conceptual framework from memory, people were saying they thought that the concepts there were helpful in identifying whether you had a claim at all or
yes.
not, right?
Yeah.
A sort of
exactly.
Absolutely.
I don't think those sorts of concepts for me are as practical to apply in trying to find the line to identify what type of claim you've got in this circumstance. So I don't see this, me even using the word no practical ability to avoid, maybe I misspeak when I use those words as far as you're concerned, but I don't think it questions whether it has a place in the conceptual framework, because I think it could be used for a different purpose.
Yeah.
I just don't think it's the best tool for making the debt equity distinction.
Classification, addresses the previous question whether the claim exists or not.
Thanks. Somewhat complementary to what Sue just said, I think it's important for us to bear in mind that we didn't discuss disclosure yet. And it's my understanding that the classification that is the main objective of the discussion so far, it's not going to possibly cover or resolve all issues related to all types of instruments that we do have. This is really shades of gray areas and many instruments with different characteristics. So I think the GAMA approach is still the best way to address the issues that we've heard. Consider what we decided before, not to make a complete change in IS 32.
Yep.
And when it comes to economic compulsion, it's also important for us to bear in mind that this is not being considered in our conceptual framework as one of the key aspects. And if we eventually have decided to consider only for classification of those instruments, we would put a significant tension on the project, and the project would take a significant amount of time to be concluded. So that said, I really support staff recommendation here, and to keep going in the GAMA approach for this aspect on when it comes to economic compulsion.
Martin.
Yeah, I also agree with the staff recommendation. And main reason for me is also because I think if we follow the other approach to flip-flop between equity and liabilities would be a nightmare and is also not helpful. And that's for me the main reason why not to follow these ideas. Secondly, what I think we have to, because I struggled with this concept in the conceptual framework of no practical ability to avoid, and Mansu explained it, but I think we need really to work on that more. Why is that relevant really for the conceptual framework for identifying a claim, and why is it not for classification? I'm struggling with that. It's a little bit, because I thought when I read the paper, is it then the first thing which is an exception of the conceptual framework, or is it not? And I had not found a good solution for that, but maybe what Sue said, maybe that is an explanation. It is to identify, do we have a claim, equity claim or liability claim, does not matter, but is not relevant for classification. Maybe that is a solution, but I'm not absolutely sure about that. And thirdly, I think when I asked for, if it comes to disclosure, because I think this project is for me a lot of additional disclosure. And do you thinking about maybe of this kind of instruments which are in a favorable position, if it is not settled really quite equity, to give this kind of disclosure? So following instruments, there is an incentive not to settle in shares then, or don't you think about this kind of disclosure? Because I think it is relevant information to users to see what kind of instruments are really in a position which there isn't a high incentive for the company not to settle in equity.
I think that there are two things that might help. The first is the presentation requirements. And in this paper, we didn't look at we didn't sort of illustrate how the attribution requirements would work within equity, because I think that would probably be the best place to kind of show that potential information. And we also have the general disclosure requirements about sort of terms and conditions, etc. But I think in terms of showing the favorability, I think measurement would be a better way to do that, and perhaps through attribution, but we haven't illustrated that as part of this. But it is part of the overall package.
We haven't signed up to that yet.
I want to echo what Martin just said. In the discussions on the conceptual framework this far, I always understood this no practical ability to avoid as helpful in determining whether something is a liability, not whether something is a claim.
We're going to look at that again, I think. That's going to come back, I think.
Yes, that's going to come
have to better.
It's going to be discussed again.
Doug.
Yes, almost the same point. Actually, I agree with staff's recommendation and staff's preliminary view, and especially what Manuel explained to Changgu was excellent. However, it's a bit too long for me to remember. You know, when I was asked by the constituents,
yes,
in the case of lease, you are saying that you have to recognize these option with the economic incentive, and in the case of price, you don't recognize it. And what is the difference? In my first impression was in the case of lease. This is because it's a part of the measurement. Lease is already liability. So in order to measure lease, you have to include option. But in the case of the FICE project, this is the matter of classification. And this relates to the equity. So therefore, in the case of equity, equity is a special, like you said, the dividend claim. So it contains the hypothetical liability, but we do not measure it. But then here comes another question, then why? Why equity special for this? Then I would be stuck with the consistency with the conceptual framework.
I wouldn't sort of, leases are different, and there's a different accounting model for leases. For instance, I think you're talking about the renewal options under leases, and I'm not an expert.
Yeah.
But you don't account for the renewal option, even though it exists, until there's a significant economic incentive, I think.
Yes.
And so that's, I think, a slightly different situation to what we have here, because, for instance, even if you do have the option,
yeah,
it would be recognized as an equity claim.
Yeah.
Okay. If we ignore sort of the economic, it would be recognized as an equity claim, and then you'd be doing some attribution of changes in value to that within equity.
Yes.
We haven't expressed that illustrated that here, but there would still be some accounting for it, and there'd still be some information being provided about that.
Right.
As part of the accounting within equity. Yeah.
But
so it's they're slightly different.
Yeah, but we do not
situations.
Call it a liability.
It wouldn't be called a liability,
yeah.
No.
But
Mary?
I'm going to start by saying support the staff recommendation, but I want to talk for a while, in part because I like to talk, but partly because I want to really congratulate the staff on all the way that you worked us through that to get to probably the most difficult issue that we had to decide on, the most difficult decision we had to make, which is about economic compulsion. And I think the way you did it, at least to me, makes it feel like a pretty straightforward decision. There are good reasons for it. And I think some of the things that you've done, and I'm saying this also to think about the things that we should be communicating, because it takes a long time to pull these things together. One is that the purpose of classification is to reflect the rights and obligations that are in the instrument. It's not to predict the outcome of what's going to happen. We need to give users of financial statements the information they need so that they can make the predictions that they want to make, but we aren't trying to anticipate those predictions in our classification. So it's back to focusing on the rights and obligations, and I think that's a really important thing that we need to try and communicate. another is, when I first read this and I was going along and I'm like, yep, indirect obligations. I get it. And then I got to the recommendation. I'm like, you're planning to throw out indirect, you know, obligations. And then, you know, I realized what you're saying is there's a difference between indirect obligations, which says the terms of the instrument establish an obligation, as opposed to it's just really, really likely. And I think we have to bring that point out more, that view A does not wipe out indirect obligations, and they remain because the terms of the instrument say that there's an obligation from day one. And I think we have to think about how we communicate that. I'm going to detour for a minute right there to conceptual framework, because one of the things I think I want to think about in terms of our conceptual framework discussion is no practical ability to avoid, how no practical ability to avoid might relate to indirectly created obligations, as opposed to being where do we set the economic and, you know, in incentives. And I don't think it's going to map directly to, you know, directly equally to either of those, but I think that's the other thing we're going to have to think about when we talk about this project versus the conceptual framework. So it's maybe whether a claim exists, but it's also maybe does it relate more to this notion or to that notion. It is one thing. I echo the concerns of others that I think if we went down an economic incentive route as an addition to the indirect obligations, that we could not do that without reassessment. I just think you can't have one without the other. And that doesn't say, oh, it's too hard, therefore we'll never do it, but I think the arguments, the benefits for doing it have largely disappeared, given that gamma seems to address, provide an underlying logic for what I think we all felt was we know we want to get to X outcome for those increasing rate prefs, and that's liability. And I think in the past, many of us reached for economic incentive, economic compulsion as the easiest explanation of why. And I think the gamma approach with the leg that says it's not equity, the payment is not tied to the residual. And that really explains a lot about what our view on equity is. And so once we have that beta leg of gamma, and that captures those increasing rate prefs, you know, the reset prefs, because what that means is the preordained resets are claims that are not tied to the residual, and therefore they are liabilities because of that. It takes away the thing that kept causing us to reach for economic compulsion. And so then, you know, with that kind of motivation gone, approach A seems a lot more attractive, logical, takes away the ugly specter of of reassessment and all the complexity that comes with it, when really economic compulsion and reassessment is doing a user's job in terms of saying, what do I now expect in light of today's economic circumstances, the outcome and the payouts will all be. So I think we need to think about what inputs somebody might need to make those projections. And that's the points that others have been making about disclosure, and you said some of the attribution with inequity, but I think it's not trying to predict the future in the day one classification. So credit on that. And I think that's really all the things that this paper kind of made me go, aha, you've really pulled it together really well. We're not trashing indirectly created obligations, but we are saying that economic incentive is not part of the classification assessment, and that we have solved our other problems. So that's a really nice package. Congratulations.
Stephen.
So I've got a question and then a comment. My question is...
It's going to spoil the fun.
It's waiting.
Are there any circumstances when a reverse convertible could be shown as a liability? And I'll give you two. One is when the option to convert, the option to settle in equity doesn't kick in until some point in the future. Presumably the coupon payments you paid prior to that classified as a liability, and you would have to then bifurcate the proceeds between the two. So you've confirmed that one. So the second one is, what if the equity settlement option doesn't have commercial substance? So I could settle in 1,000 of cash or 10 million shares currently worth 10 million.
Well, I think we're going to talk about sort of substance in a future paper about substantive rights and obligations. I think what we were trying to get to here is where the if assuming they are substantive and the entity does have, you know, the right to exercise those options, whether the incentives to exercise one way or another should be considered. I think in terms of commercial substance, I think we already have some discussion about commercial substance in IS 32.
But it still does introduce a difficult line, doesn't it?
It does, but it's one people are already coping with today.
But Steve, can I come in? I think it does. It does bring in. But I think I would say that line is much easier to judge than some of the economic compulsion issues, because there it is a the contract, it becomes, I would say, much more easily obvious that it has just been brought in to achieve an objective and doesn't have any economic impact. And the best way to look at it is when you look at the valuations of these things, and these things are not even considered.
Okay.
So I would say, I'm not saying there's no judgment involved, but I think that's an easier threshold to look at. And people already do that because we have guidance in 32.
I'm happy
yeah.
with your answer, and I'm happy with the recommendation. I agree with all of your analysis.
You had a comment.
So my comment is, and I agree with not bifurcating, because you could bifurcate into a debt instrument and a put option, for example, and I agree the reasons for that. But this all really depends upon the quality of the disclosure and all the presentation. I know you're going to bring it back, but I just feel that in order to properly communicate the impact that these instruments have on the common shareholders, and they do add leverage to different degrees, they add leverage to those common shareholders, we need to go beyond simply describing the terms and conditions. I'd like to see the fair value disclosed at each balance sheet date. I'd like to see a bifurcation at each balance sheet date. I'd like to see attribution, earnings per share, because
it is important. Yeah.
That it's a comprehensive package that really enables the equity investors to understand the impact that it has.
But for the attributions, Steve, you didn't want fair value. You had your own approach.
You didn't want fair value, Steve.
That was funny fair value, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The residual effects can
be
very...
It was sophisticated fair value.
But I think we have, for instance, three different approaches to attribution, which the board didn't sort of come to a conclusion on. We're going to explore, as part of the discussion paper, different ways that you might attribute the amounts for different types of instruments. And I think, for instance, these instruments would be one of those instruments where we would try and show the potential attribution for and see which way provides better, and talk to users about which way provides better information. But I think the point is, we will have those tools now. At the moment, it gets equity classified and you get nothing.
Yeah.
And the only way you get information at the moment is through liability classification.
It's not even an EPS, it's
anti-dilutive. Because these are anti-dilutive at the moment, because it's the entity's option, they don't come up under EPS as well.
I agree, and that's the big problem.
And which is why I think the attribution proposals that we've got as part of this project are a big improvement to what information is currently provided under EPS. Do you agree?
As long as it's done right, I agree.
But the sophisticated fair values.
Gary.
Yeah. I also agree with the staff's recommendations for a lot of the reasons stated here and one or two others. And I think if there's perhaps in any of our financial instrument type accounting or FICE accounting that something should probably be transaction driven, it's this particular fact set. It, you know, like your paper points out, sometimes the option to do this is always there. Sometimes it's at particular points in time or after a point in time, so on. So let's take the situation where the entity could call, you know, with or trigger the transaction, and by any economic analysis, there's a huge great benefit to do so, but they don't. So does that say the economic analysis is wrong? No, it doesn't. It just says it wasn't compelling enough to trigger it. I think we should keep in mind that companies' capitalization decisions are made for all sorts of qualitative, quantitative, objective, and subjective reasons, some of which might not make sense in an economics classroom, but make sense to the corporate structure. And then I think if you take the other scenario where that call date hasn't come yet, you know, and it's sometime in the future, might be near term, might be very long term out. And if you're going to go to the economic compulsion argument, I mean, again, the analysis will get more of the money, less of the money over time, and I don't think you necessarily want to introduce that into the accounting as well. And even if you did, at what point in time is it close enough that any kind of whatever positions safe and deep in the money is likely to hold? You know, so again, I think you go back to transactions as they occur, or perhaps, you know, when you announce an irrevocable claim to do so, you know, within a period of time, kind of like trade date versus settlement date. But I think you've got the right answer for a lot of reasons.
Philippe?
Well, maybe what I'm going to say is not very incremental to others, but the way I see it, there is a spectrum and continuity. On one end, you have the option, could be A or B, depends on the assessment. We tell you some days A, sometimes it's B, and it's every day could change, and you have to reassess if you base your classification upon the analysis of the option. Then you have this continuum, which ends at the no practical ability, or the no commercial substance, maybe, as well. And somewhere in between, you have the economic compulsion. It becomes clearer that option A is more likely than option B when you look at the outcomes. And as you continue, it becomes very, very clear, and becomes even absolutely, well, nearly certain that unless you are totally full, you will do A rather than B. And this is what I call no practical ability, or this is what could be named no commercial substance, because it's just artificial. So if we adopt your proposal, I say to one end of the spectrum, I'm fine, because I would not say you have to reassess all the time. And when I move down this spectrum and I come near to no practical ability, I say, well, are not we trying with IFRS to depict the commercial substance, the real economic situation, rather than the legalistic approach? Because this is a kind of legalistic approach. Oh, the contract says you could avoid to pay, but it has no commercial substance. So where should we stop and say, no, it's no longer good. We have to follow the economic reality. And where to draw the line is the question you ask. And I don't know. This is a difficult question. So I think I would agree with your proposal, except for, at some point, it's not really depicting faithfully the economic situation of the entity. And I don't know how to draw the line, but I think we should keep in mind, and disclosures is not a proxy for good accounting. It's important, but it's not a proxy for good accounting.
But we would also be looking at classes of equity, no?
Yes, exactly. So
it could also be made more better visible.
Yeah,
on
because
the face.
This is a.
Yes, but still, you know, people, when they look at the financial statement, they don't always go into the details of analyzing the.
More than
details. Yeah.
But
it's better than today,
yeah.
I think. And mm-hmm. it, sure, that there is. I mean, we're not going to be able to resolve all the issues about sort of people applying judgment as to what the facts are. People are going to have to apply judgment as to what the rights and obligations are of the instrument, and we're going to come back and talk about substance, etc. However, even if that judgment is kind of borderline, if you even if you end up with equity classification for some of these instruments, we are still going to be providing information about those instruments as part of within equity. And I think that's an important point, because it kind of alleviates some of the tension of making that judgment call.
Yeah.
And because at the moment you get a very stark difference between liability and equity, and so we're reducing that difference in terms of
criteria on economic substance. At least you can get rid of the clear possibilities of abuse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But I also think,
and then with classification and disclosures, you can provide additional.
But still, the outcome is that the remuneration of the instrument is not a debit to P&L, it's an attribution. And this is very key. I mean, you can always improve disclosure, but still you have this outcome in the P&L, which for me is.
But I do think, Philippe, that your concern about the extreme end is addressed today and will continue to be addressed by the indirectly established obligations, which doesn't go away, you know, that's there now, and that says if it's structured in such a way that from day one,
I hope you're right.
You know, that's there and that's being kept.
I hope you're right. I will be looking at it from outside now, but
thank you. Just another clarification on paragraph 46. The first question is the IAS 32, paragraph 20, that many board members already pointed out, this is a kind of indirect kind of a classification based on substance of the transaction. And there you said that we are going to retain this paragraph 20 So I'm just a little confused based on our discussion. Is it consistent with the view A?
Yes.
Retaining this
the indirect obligation.
This is the indirect obligation.
Because it's looking at the rights and obligations which are in the contract, and if the rights and obligations are such that they establish an obligation for the entity indirectly, then it's just a reflection of the obligation of the entity. It's not about the economic incentives as such, because for these obligations the entity is in effect guaranteed the liability settlement outcome.
So in the case of this IS 32 paragraph 20, there's no kind of a likelihood to exercise one of these two options.
Well, it's not about the likelihood.
Not
about the likelihood, because the rights and obligations have established kind of that the liability settlement outcome has been guaranteed,
mm-hmm.
because the equity settlement outcome is always going to be greater than that. So it's just a question of the arrangements of the rights and obligations in the contract, as opposed to having a right to one outcome and another outcome where the favorability may change.
Okay, the second one is the second sentence of paragraph 46. You said there need to be updated to reflect the gamma approach.
But that's a general point about the requirements of IAS 32. We'd be going through them to update to implement the gamma approach fully. So.
Okay. The last thing is just the editorial comment. Based on the past papers you prepared, you know, they were so excellent to understand what you're trying to say, because you provide some examples based on new explanation, new descriptions. So it was much easier to understand what you're trying to say to us. But this time, there's no examples on the view A, view B. So it's really difficult to follow all your logic, you know, explanation. So next time, if you can, maybe provide some example based on the different alternatives.
Yes. Sorry, we'll do. Did you mean in terms of numbers?
Yes, maybe
okay.
The classification,
yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so I feel that the ISB agrees with the staff's preliminary view in this.
All in favor?
All in favor.
Okay.
Is this Philippe, is this your last official vote?
We're not done yet.
Oh, no, we're done. Question.
Oh, Philippe will, for this, that was the only question for Fias, yeah. And Philippe will send
So finally,